Hello and welcome to Literary Lunch, a light lunch for your literary appetite. I'm Eli, introducing part two of our conversation with author Martha Wells, which we recorded back in January. In part one of our conversation, we discussed her short story, The Salt Witch, the merits of genre fiction, and the process differences between writing a short story and writing a novel. In today's part of the conversation, we discuss her novels, in particular her Murderbot Diaries saga, the next installment of which, Fugitive Telemetry, is coming out on April 27th. So, without any more delay, please enjoy our conversation with Martha Wells. I thought it would be nice to have a little bit of sort of a warm-up transition question, sort of to shift gears a little bit. So I thought it might be fun to think about if you could sit down and watch any TV show with Murderbot and get its running commentary, what would you watch?
Oh gosh, there's so many. I think maybe Legends of Tomorrow is kind of the one that first comes to mind because it's so wacky and so fun and so gonzo, and they're doing a lot of fighting and sneaking into places, and there are things like that they would be interested in. But also I think it would just like the unreality of it, and also like the way the relationships between the characters. I think it would like that too. I can think of some I would want to sit with just to hear it criticize that was going on. I have, back in the before times when we could get together in groups, I have a friend that we'll watch TV with my husband and some other people, and we are really bad at just dissecting the show if it doesn't keep us interested, 100%. I mean, we're really good at watching Doctor Who and things like that, but shows that don't keep our attention, we'll sit there and talk about, oh, they're in that set, but in a different, it's the angle differently now. And we watch Father Brown and just sit there and are like, oh, they, now that this season, they're not allowed to go near the church. There must be a restraining order. They can only get within 500 yards of this building they normally film outside. And stuff like that. We notice way too much, basically. But that would be fun to do with Murderbot, because I can think of a lot of shows that it would critique like that.
Now, do you think Murderbot would be a Trekkie?
Murderbot, I'm not sure Murderbot would be into fandom in a way that, we are, that humans do. I think that it would probably like all the Star Trek. It would probably watch it and be happy about it. But because, again, it's people, working together, humans at a safe distance, working together and being friends and doing exciting things, basically, is its criteria. So, and also Star Trek doesn't have a lot of sex scenes that it would need to fast forward through, since they usually stop at kissing and things. So I think it would like that.
Yeah, it might not be Jim Kirk's biggest fan.
Actually, there's not as much of that in the original Star Trek as people think. It's kind of gotten become apocryphal over the years. There's a really good article that someone wrote in Strange Horizons about the perception of Jim Kirk as being, just this total sleazeball after the women, and then what actually happened on the show, which is not really buried out at all. And it says interesting things about our perception of he's a very masculine character, and what our perception of that masculinity actually is based on, and how we overlay that on the reality of what was actually happening in the TV show.
Yeah, I haven't watched a ton of TOS, just like a couple of the big hits and a couple of movies. So I have to admit to not knowing Jim Kirk that well.
Yeah, but it's like the perception of him. So it's an interesting name. And that's it's in Strange Horizons. I can't remember now who wrote that article, but it's in Strange Horizons, I'm pretty sure.
Well, that sounds super interesting. So I guess before we get really into things, you probably already figured it out, but
I'm a major Murderbot fan, and it's the only series where I own ebook and audiobook copies of all the books.
Oh, cool.
And I'm not the only one by a long shot. I gave a copy of All Systems Red to my little sister for Christmas, and she told me later on that she, like, sat down in bed, and she was going to read a couple of chapters before bed, and then she ended up staying up all night reading the entire thing in one sitting.
Well, cool.
Yeah, so, I guess that kind of leads me to my first question. It's a bit long, because it's a very specific thing I wanted to ask. So your first novel, The Element of Fire, came out in 1993, before the internet really drastically changed how people find and share and react to books. But by the time All Systems Red came out, it was possible to see people reacting to your book essentially in real time.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering what it's been like to write through that huge cultural shift to where you can directly see how many people are connecting with your work. Has it changed the way you see your writing at all to be able to get a real sense of the huge impact it's had in certain circles?
I think it helps my motivation a lot. I actually worked in computer support from the 90s up to around 2006, computer support and then writing programs and working with software and databases and everything. So a lot of my work was actually on the internet later on. So I think I had, my learning curve wasn't as steep as it has been for some writers who are not very computer oriented people. But yeah, when the first book came out, basically it was very exciting, but things happened so much more slowly. The book is published and you have a party with your friends if you're lucky and maybe do a signing at your local bookstore and then you just wait. And it really, and especially if you, fortunately there's a lot of conventions around, you know, that have been coming and going through the years, not too far from where I live. So I was able to go to conventions and that was kind of your only time to kind of see people reacting to the book. And so, we just seemed to take ages before anybody, you know, it was very exciting. I went to Worldcon with a really good friend of mine and I did a reading and I think this was for the Ships of Air, the second Milrean book, and came out and she was like, it's so cool to see people other than us talking about your books and reading your work. Because she had never seen that before because it was always just our little group of people. So yeah, it was a completely different experience. And I feel kind of sorry for writers today, especially people who are more introverted or just not used to that kind of attention, suddenly going from 0 to 100, basically, and not having any kind of preparation for what that's going to be like, where suddenly people are commenting on your work to your face and, you know, you see a lot of, you see a lot of criticism and you see a lot of people, you know, on Twitter wanting you to go read their bad reviews for whatever reason. It's like, the book's published. The publisher's not going to take it back and fix it. So it doesn't, you know, there's not really anything anybody can do at this point. And that kind of thing. And it's like how trying to deal with that and just the stress of, it seems so much more stressful to have a book that is popular right out of the gate now. For The Element of Fire, it was not popular, but the Earthing was kind of a slow build back then. It took a while for people to start reading stuff, and you didn't get to see a lot of reviews on the internet to point you to books, so people were just finding them in the bookstore. So having a popular book was probably still stressful at that time, but it wasn't where it just suddenly happens overnight. And I see so many new writers have their book, you know, their first novel comes out and it's a big hit and they start having problems. Basically, it's hard to deal with it. It's like your life changes completely. Whereas back then, you know, back in the pre-internet days, your life would change, but it was a slower process. You would have kind of more time to control it. So yeah, it's just been completely different. I'm kind of glad that I didn't have a big overnight popular hit until All Systems Red, which I think is like my 19th book or something. I can't remember. the only other book I had that before this was The Death of the Necromancer, which was probably the last book I had that came out before ebooks. No, actually, I guess the Ilrian trilogy was not, the contract was not written for ebook. There was a big transition phase where some things were coming out and ebooks were just sort of starting to get going. And so not all contracts had mentioned ebooks. And that's why my first four novels, when they went out of print, I put them out because, you know, there was no ebook back then. So yeah, it's like the Death of the Necromancer got a little bit popular and did pretty well. Was actually nominated for a Nebula Award, but that was kind of the last thing I had where it was getting some attention. And so by the time I was doing, I had a career collapse there from about 2008 to 2011 or so. And then finally the Cloud Roads came out. And so it was like I was kind of restarting my career. But I had all the experience with, you know, talking to people and having to go places and deal with, you know, publicity and things like that. So it wasn't new for me. And so by the time All Systems Red came out, and it was suddenly just like, I didn't really believe it at first. It was I think it was the publisher had arranged a kind of it's a signing where basically a pre-order signing where people pre-order the book from an independent store. And then you go in and sign all the books and they ship them out. You don't do an in-person event. And so Murder by the Book in Houston had arranged that. And I drove up there with a friend of mine to go to the store and sign the books. And they were telling me, we almost didn't get this case of books because, you know, the warehouse was empty.
Wow.
And usually when that happens, it means the publisher just didn't bother putting the books out. But and they were like, no, they had to go to walk around the publisher's office, and the publicist basically stole up back everyone's copies that had been passed out so they could make up this box for us. And so I was kind of like, yeah, well, that's probably just a distribution problem. You know, it's not that exciting. But and then they were like, no, we think that it's actually been doing really well. And it had actually, because they're the tour.com novellas, they did a much smaller print run. And so, and then it was just kind of this build of like, gosh, a lot of people are talking about this book and, you know, it seems to be doing really well. And I kind of really didn't dawn on me how well it was doing. You know, I was starting to be hopeful, but until I got the call that it was nominated for the Nebula Award. And so, and then it was really starting to, and then, you know, I thought, well, maybe it will be nominated for the Hugo, and it was. And so that was kind of a thing. And then at the Hugo Awards, my editor actually told me how many copies they'd sold up to that point. And that was a big shock. So yeah, it was a really strange experience and still kind of is. I'm still kind of like, slightly disassociated by it. I don't know. I'm not really sure it's actually happening sometimes.
Yeah. I mean, I get why you're still processing, because it's not like this happened like years and years and years ago. It's been like 3 years, and you've put out like four novellas and a novel, and you have another one coming out in April. What's it like keeping up with that tight of a release schedule? I know you said you write like 1,000 words a day, but you know, with so much revision and so stuff like that, how do you keep up with it? Does it get overwhelming?
Well, All Systems Red was written about, I want to say it was at least 7 or 8 months before they put it out. I think it was in May. I think it sold around August or September, because I found out that it was going to sell at actually the Worldcon, which would have been in August. And I think that and the rest was just, you know, getting the contract and going through that stuff. So it was already written by that point. It had actually been written about in June or July. And then, and I think it came out in May, so it wasn't a full year. And then they had already asked for, when they bought All Systems Red, they'd already asked for the second book. So I was working on Artificial Condition. I think I'd actually finished Artificial Condition well before All Systems Red came out. And then we decided to do two more. And so I was working on those that summer when All Systems Red was sort of starting to get really popular. So Yeah, they're done pretty, they're pretty far ahead of time. They were, they're different. They're kind of hard to write. The first one, All Systems Red, came out really easily. I wrote it in about a month.
Wow.
And I'd had a back injury and some other stuff going on during that period, but it went pretty quickly. The others have been very difficult. They each took about 3 months, and I ended up writing, there's a lot of revision. I'll write like 5,000 words, 10,000 words, and end up going back and cutting most of it out. It's kind of having to find the story by writing the wrong version of the story and having to get rid of it and go and start again. And then the novel was the same way. Network Effect, it took me 18 months to write Network Effect, and usually it takes me 11 to 12 months to write a novel, especially that one. It's not very long for a novel. It's 110,000 words. And my fantasy novels are usually at least 130, you know, or a little bit longer. So yeah, 18 months. And then a lot of it, again, was probably the first 50,000 words took me most of that time. It was just kind of, you know, constant. I also had stopped and did some work for the Magic story for Magic the Gathering during that period too. So it wasn't always all Murderbot. But yeah. It's been an interesting trip. And I kind of did need a break, I think. But I just would have preferred a break that didn't involve a pandemic.
Yeah.
For one thing, this year was going to be my first book tour that the public sent me on. Usually they don't, you know, I'd never been sent on one before. Usually something that most, they would arrange a couple of signings. My other publishers would arrange a couple of signings at things like, you know, at local bookstores or, you know, bookstores in Houston. But this is going to be my first one where I was actually going to be flown around the country and do it. And so, of course, I had to be canceled. And I know a lot of writers who were getting ready to go on their first book tour that and it was all canceled. So kind of depressing.
Yeah. That's really rough.
Yeah. Well, it's okay. It's like, I was kind of thinking, well, this is really stressful. And then it's like, well, now it's canceled and I'm not really sure that was great. But yeah, so it's been it was really scary though, to have Network Effect come out during the pandemic, because it was just an up and down thing of, you know, everything will be okay. And then 5 minutes later, you're like, no, it will tank. Everything will be terrible. Publishers were having to reschedule things, not because they didn't think they would sell, but because they didn't think they would be able to get the paper time, because there was a paper shortage there because of everything going on. Printers could only work, were having to close down and then reopen and because of COVID. And so books were, the books that were put off because of that. But the publisher had to kind of strategically look at what was coming out. And what was, you know, and try to get enough copies. That was why it was kind of hard to order books over Christmas, because it's like they were telling people, no, if you know you want to give it as a gift, order it 3 months ahead of time, so you might have a chance that they'll get in. So yeah, that was a really scary thing. And I know other writers whose books were coming out about that same time were really worried too, even pretty popular writers. So yeah, so it was kind of a relief when it came out, and it hit the New York Times bestseller list. Actually, it's the second time it did. All Systems Red hit the New York Times bestseller list for audio. A lot of that was Kevin R. Free, his portrayal. So yeah, it's been a very scary year to have a book come out, and it feels like this happened, you know, a million years ago. That was back in, I guess it came out in May. And it was like, it just feels like May was like in another century.
Right.
I barely remember that.
Wasn't Molly Tanzer who said that she was waiting to get through March, and then March just kept happening?
Yeah. Well, even now, especially this past week or 2 weeks, whatever it's been, I don't even remember. I'll see like an answer to an email or something. You know, I left a comment on something to someone on January 10th, and they'll reply, and I'll be like, January 10th? And then be like, this is only the 16th. You know, that was But January 10th was like 5 or 6 months ago. it's just been a ride.
Time feels fake during this pandemic. It's like, was it a day ago? Was it a year ago? Who knows?
It's a lot. So I've read in some of the other interviews you've done that Murderbot started as, or rather, All Systems Red started as a short story and then grew into a novella and then a series. And I guess you said that you're going to write more, you just need a break. And I was kind of wondering if we will get to see more of Murderbot and Art's adventures after the events of Network Effect, since the upcoming novella is set before a Network event takes place.
Yeah, I do want to do that. I'm working on a couple of different ideas, and I kind of got bogged down on those. Those were the ones I kind of got bogged down on after Christmas when I'd finished Fugitive Telemetry. So yeah, that's my plan, and I'm kind of like, and I need to do a second Murderbot novel also.
Oh.
So it's going to be the usual thing where it'll seem very easy when it comes out, but it'll just will have taken me like a lot of blood and sweat to get through it. So I'm probably going to start on Murderbot again as soon as I finish this fantasy novel, which is going really slowly right now. So it'll hopefully will be probably, I hope the middle of next year, I'll start on Murderbot again and probably with a novella. But yeah, I do want to write kind of the follow up to Network Effect, because even at the time I felt like there's a lot more that they have to do, you know, in this system. This is a good place to end this story, but they still have to, you know, deal with these people that have been through this experience down on the planet and try to get them out of harm's way and the other. And there's lots of different ways that story could go. So that's what I'm going to be working on.
Yeah, absolutely. That's going to be. I'm really interested to see where you go from where you left off. I'm just very excited about the possibilities. And actually, another thing I wanted to ask about, it touches not more on your works in general, not just Murderbot, but I've noticed in the Murderbot diaries and also from what I've seen in the books of the Raxura, there's just so much world building. And they all have rich histories behind them. And I was wondering, how do you create that kind of world building? Is it something that you've had to learn over the years? Well, of course it is, but how has that developed for you?
Well, I used to do, when my first few books, or at least the Elrian books, were very kind of set in alternate secondary world versions of real places. And I did a lot of research to try to really capture that feeling, like to capture the feeling of a world that was based on 17th century France, or a world that was based on Europe in the 1920s or something. So I did a lot of research. And one of the things I did when I switched over to the Raxura books was I kind of decided I was not going to worry as much about making things seem realistic as I was going to just go for more kind of out there secondary world fantasy, which was the kind of stuff I really liked to read in the 70s and 80s. So what I did with the Raxura books, I didn't do as much research. I did some, you know, kind of spot things where I realized I needed to know how something would happen or work or something like that. But I would just basically, as I was writing the Cloud Roads, you know, hit a point and like the turning, I don't know if you've gotten to this point that there's this, the rotating city in the Cloud Roads.
Yes. Oh my God.
Yeah. When I first was writing that scene, they were just stopping at a camp that was there. And I thought, well, that's kind of boring. It has to be a town. And it was a town, and then it was a city. And I thought, you know, I kind of came up with the idea of the steam, and then thought, well, what if it's the steam is like making the whole plateau rotate. The whole city is a giant machine, basically. And so I kind of came up with the idea with that of whatever I come up with, I'll try to make it just cooler and neater and more fun and more exciting. And so that's how I approach the world building. It's like, how can this thing be bigger and weirder? How can this place be stranger? You know, that kind of idea. So that was a lot of fun to play with. And that's kind of one of the things that made the book so fun for me to write. So it's a complete, I mean, you kind of still have to, I mean, people will talk a lot about world building is for verisimilitude, is trying to make the world feel real. but a world can be very fantastic. And a lot of the times your answer to, well, how does this work, is magic when you're writing a fantasy. But you also need to, people need to see kind of how that works, even if it's magic. It's like, as long as there's some system, it's like, well, how do you just kind of have to ask yourself things like, how do these people get food? How do they get water? How do they get their stuff, their clothes, their pots and pans? It's like, do they make them? Are they trading? And when you just touch on where people can see that this is a working place, that people, that there are ways to do that, it doesn't feel, it makes it feel more grounded, and people are more ready to suspend their disbelief.
Right. So you don't necessarily front load a lot of the world building, and it sort of kind of grows more organically from the story.
Yeah. I think when I did my first novel, when I did Element of Fire and, and to a certain extent, City of Bones, even that's more, it's more kind of an out there secondary world fantasy. It's based on a bunch of different desert environments, basically. I did more front loading of world building. Now more what I do is I start developing the characters and thinking about what kind of world would create these characters and what kind of world they would move through for my plot to work, and then I kind of build out from there. And, you know, doing some things like looking through Atlas Obscura is a good source to kind of look through when you're trying to think of, okay, I need a strange place, you know, for them to stop at or to have this scene take place. What is it going to look at? And what's it going to look like? And you can look through Atlas Obscura and see these, like, particularly rock formations. There's a lot of cases of people coming on strange rock formations and thinking they're actually been man-made just because they're so odd. Those are kind of a good source for strange cities to kind of start as your basis for what a strange city would look like. And that kind of thing, you can kind of like world build from a lot of natural environments and think, well, okay, well, this looks really cool. How would someone live in it? What would they have to do? You know, and also just taking natural environments and putting them in different circumstances. Like I think it's in The Harbors of the Sun, where Moon and Stone encounter that. It's like a flying island, but it's literally made out of tree roots. So it's kind of taking something that happens usually on the ground or, you know, in the water and putting it up in the sky, and it becomes kind of a completely different environment. So there's stuff like that, you know. A lot of my secondary world fantasy is taking things that don't belong somewhere and sticking them there and then trying to make it work. So it is a lot of fun. It is a lot. That's why I really have a lot of fun with fantasy.
Yeah, so I guess we should probably head towards wrapping up. But I just want to say thank you so much for your time. It's been really exciting to get the chance to talk to you. And I just want to make sure our readers know that Fugitive Telemetry is coming out at the end of April. Everyone needs to go and buy it and read it and probably buy it in audiobook again, because they're very easy to read or listen to multiple times. At least for me, I'm autistic, so I really just enjoy going back to familiar, comforting things over and over again.
God, I do too.
Yeah. And then I like to read them, and then I listen to them with my husband, and I'm like, look, this is good. And it's fun bonding.
Oh, it is.
Yeah, so is there anything else you wanted to say?
I don't think so. Thank you so much for inviting me. I really enjoyed talking to y'all.
Oh, thank you. It was so much fun.
Thank you so much. A cool person wanted to talk to us again. This is crazy, Beth. We're like really running a streak here.
Well, that's cool. Yeah, and I don't usually get the chance to talk about short stories very much. So that's also neat.
Yeah, I mean your short fiction is really good too, and especially if it's like really different for you to write, it's fun to talk about that too, and not just Murderbot all the time.
Yeah, talk about Murderbot a lot.
Yeah, but, I bet.
I like Murderbot, so it's not a problem.
Yeah.
Great. I guess on that note, have a wonderful day, and thank you so much again.
Well, y'all too.
Yep, and thank you so much.
Thank you so much for joining us for that episode of Literary Lunch. Special thanks to Martha Wells for agreeing to sit down and talk with us. If you would like to find more of our episodes, you can visit our website at literarylunchpodcast.wordpress.com. Visit our Twitter at litlunchcast. And if you would like to support us monetarily, you can donate to our coffee at ko-fi.com/literarylunch. Bye!